From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, one of the pilots at this weekend's Capital Air Show says which trick even he doesn't do because it's too dangerous. Also, how one program at Sac State got an exemption so that it alone can accept new students next spring. And indie country singer Elliot Randall in our studio. But first, an update on a story we've covered before. Last November, California voters approved the creation of a Citizens Redistricting Commission. That means California citizens will redraw the state's legislative boundaries, not elected officials as currently happens. The job of figuring out how to choose the people who'll serve on the Redistricting Commission was given to the Bureau of State Audits. Next Monday, the Bureau holds a public hearing in Sacramento to get feedback on its plan. State Auditor Elaine Howell joins us with details. Elaine Howell, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us what these people are going to be doing once they're chosen to serve on the Redistricting Commission.
Actually, the Redistricting Commission has a very, very important role in California's future. These 14 members of this commission will be drawing the lines for the various legislative districts, both assembly districts, Senate districts, and Board of Equalization districts.
Well, it's sensitive work and it's political work. How do you determine who's appropriate to serve on such a commission?
Well, we're confident that, first of all, the pool of candidates is the 17 million voters in California. Any voter can apply to be on the commission. We have our regulations, as you indicated. We have a hearing on Monday at the Crest Theater to hear comment on the regulations that my staff have drafted. And those provide information about who would be qualified for the commission, how to apply for the commission, how that process is going to work. But we're confident that we will get a lot of applicants from our voters in California.
Based on the plan as you currently have it, who would be qualified to serve in the commission? We know that you have to be a voter in California. Is there anything else that specifically qualifies people or, for that matter, disqualifies them?
Well, there's a variety of conflict of interest provisions in the initiative itself, and the regulations reflect that. I would encourage people to go to the website, our website, bsa.ca.gov. We have a redistricting navigation link in there at where the regulations are, and we've laid out the kinds of things that would conflict someone out. For example, if someone has worked for a California legislator or has contributed to a campaign. There are very specific provisions, but there's certainly broad opportunity for lots of people to qualify for the commission. There isn't anything specific that you would need to qualify. You certainly want to appreciate diversity in California. You need to be able to perform certain types of analytical skills because some of this process, as we know, will be very complex.
You said that having contributed to a campaign could be a disqualification. I mean, that sounds like a lot of people could fit into that category.
Well, there is a certain dollar amount. It's a $2,000 if you've contributed to a campaign in that amount or greater. And the purpose of this we want this to be a citizens redistricting commission. That's what the voters intended when they approved Prop 11. So we still believe that there are going to be a lot of people out there who have the qualifications, who do not have any of the conflicts that are identified in the initiative.
My guest is Elaine Howell, California State Auditor. Her office was given the job by last year's Proposition 11 of figuring out how to create a citizens' commission to redraw California's legislative districts. They have a plan, and there's a public hearing to discuss it on Monday in Sacramento. It's at the Crest Theater from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. I'm sure there are going to be some people who will say, I'd love to serve in this commission because that way I can stick it to the Democrats or stick it to the Republicans and help draw the lines to make it harder for them to get elected.
Well, I'm not sure that there will be individuals like that. We're looking for, again, remember that the commission is 14 individual members from various parties, representatives of the Republican Party, representatives of the Democratic Party, and certainly representatives of neither of those parties, either individuals who are declined a state, independent party, et cetera. So there's going to be a good mix of individuals on this commission. And they have a very important role in making sure that they draw districts that are going to work for all Californians.
So is there a determined ratio of Democrats, Republicans, and others?
On the commission itself, there are the initiative requires that there be 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 4 of neither of those two majority parties. So it can be 4 individuals who are declined a state or a mix of individuals who are neither Democrats nor Republicans.
How much work do you think it's going to be for someone if they're chosen to serve on this redistricting commission? How long a period of time will it last, do you think? And how much time in a given week or month?
Well, the commission itself has to be created by the end of next calendar year. So by December of 2010, the commission has to be created. We have to finish our work. And then the commission commences its work as soon as possible, immediately in 2011. And it, depending upon the complexity of the work, it could take them several months. I know that they have to have their work done by September of 2011.
If it's going to take quite a lot of time for someone over a several-month period, are they going to be compensated?
There is a provision in the initiative, and we actually have that in the regulations as well, that commissioners will be compensated $300 per day plus any additional expenses that they incur to be able to conduct their responsibilities as a member of the commission.
Have there been any unexpected problems in this process that your office has confronted while figuring out how to create the Citizens Redistricting Commission?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call them problems, but certainly challenges. And when we see challenges, we also see opportunities. We think we're going to need assistance from stations like yours, viewers like yours, who can get the word out about the commission. We're hoping to get help from various organizations throughout California to help us with what we're calling a grassroots campaign. This is a statewide campaign to reach out to all voters in California to educate them about the commission, the importance of the commission, and this wonderful opportunity to participate in a process that's going to have an impact on California's future.
Your agency, the Bureau of State Audits, was given this job to create the Citizens Commission. This is not the normal work of your office. Given that you've been given this big task, and with the backdrop of layoffs, frozen positions, furloughs in state government, is this having an impact on the auditors' ability to do their regular auditing work?
Well, we're trying to balance all of our different responsibilities. Certainly, that's a challenge, again, and again, as I see it, an opportunity for us to become as effective and efficient as we can as an organization. We not only have to have the responsibility of this creating this redistricting commission, but we're also doing quite a bit of work related to federal stimulus money coming into California. My office has primary responsibility for that, and we certainly want to conduct and complete the audits that the legislature brings to my office or requests that my office do. So we're trying to balance everything. It is a challenge, but we're doing the best we can and exercising due diligence in doing all of the projects that we're responsible for.
You've got this public hearing on Monday in Sacramento so that you can get some feedback to the plan for creating the Citizens Redistricting Commission. What happens after that?
After we receive all the comments on Monday during the hearing, people can provide written comments. We've already received some comments from folks, but we're anxious to hear what people's opinions are of the regulations and any suggestions for modification. Once we complete the hearing on Monday, my staff will make any necessary revisions that we think are important to tighten up the regulations or strengthen them. Then we will in all likelihood, release the regulations again for a shorter period of time for comment. Once the regulations are final, which we expect to happen in late October, the next big step is the application process. And we'll be accepting applications beginning of middle of December of this year through about the middle of February 12th of next year. So we'll be doing a lot of outreach, a lot of advertising, campaigning, trying to get the word out to encourage people to apply to become a member of this commission.
That could be a big task in itself. If you get a lot of applications, there's no way to gauge, I guess, at this point, how many people will apply, but it's possible a lot of people could apply.
That's correct. And we encourage people. We want a lot of people to apply because we want to have the opportunity to look at as many qualified applicants and identify those applicants for that pool we have to create. We have to create a pool of 60 individuals to send to the legislature sometime next year. Late in October of next year, we need to submit 60 names to the legislature. So it certainly will be a challenge, and it is hard to predict how many applications we will receive. But our challenge and our intent is to have as many people apply as possible.
Finally, Elaine, does the legislature or the governor or both have to sign off on the plan that your office is creating?
They don't necessarily have to sign off on the plan, but we certainly invite them to comment on our regulations. I mean, our regulations really are the process that we intend to use. It mirrors the initiative, which it's required to do, but it is our plan and our approach for how we're going to create this commission. So we encourage comment from any and everyone.
Elaine Howell, California State Auditor. Her office was given the job by last year's Proposition 11 of figuring out how to create a citizens commission to redraw California's legislative districts. They have a plan, and there's a public hearing to discuss it on Monday in Sacramento at the Crest Theater from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Elaine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, how one program at Sac State manages to keep its doors open to new students next spring. We'll be right back. Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to capradio.org/insight for links, images, and information about our topics and guests. A little later this morning, we'll talk G-forces with an aerobatic pilot at this weekend's Capital Air Show. But first, the state's budget problems have forced Sacramento State and other CSU campuses to shut its doors to new students next spring. But one program in Sacramento is exempt. What program is that, and how is it managing to accept new students when no others are? With the answers is Deidre Sessoms, Professor and Director of Teacher Preparation at Sacramento State. Deidre, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
What is the program that is still going to be open to new students?
Actually, we have three programs. We have the multiple subject credential program, which is elementary teachers, the single subject program, which is generally junior high and high school teachers, and then special education as well.
Well, what's the secret? Why are your programs still accepting new students when no others are, as far as I know, in California in the CSU system?
Well, I think it's important to understand the context of the CSU and our link with the public schools in California. We prepare the vast majority of teachers who will go into our public schools, generally about 53% to 55% of the teachers who teach our children in K through 12 came through a CSU system.
What would happen if you are not able to accept new students in the spring and the fall?
Well, I think initially, probably not a lot, but in a very short period of time, we'd start to see a shortage of teachers. We all know with the budgets and increase in class size that teachers have gotten pink slipped recently, which means they were laid off. And so it would make you wonder, well, why do we need to keep accepting new students into the program? Partly, really, it is to prepare for the future. We know that in the next 7 to 10 years, about a third of the teachers who are credentialed in the state will be eligible to retire. We think they're going to be ready to take some time off.
But couldn't you make the argument that most programs, maybe even arguably all programs at Sac State and other CSU campuses, are important investments in the future?
Well, certainly you could do that. I think you have to also realize that the CSU system can't afford to educate students that they don't receive money from the state to educate. And so since we're only receiving enough money to educate about 3,000 fewer students on our campus by next year, somehow we've got to cut 3,000. We certainly don't want to do that by saying to students who are already in the system, you can't continue. That wouldn't make sense at all. So we have to then stop accepting students into new programs to get to that 3,000.
My guest is Deidre Sessoms. She's Professor and Director of Teacher Preparation at Sacramento State. Sac State's teacher credentialing program is still open to new students next spring, which is very unusual because all CSU schools have closed admission for the spring and fall 2010 semesters to new students. Given that the campus needs to reduce the student body size, does that mean other departments are now having to cut even more students because the teacher credentialing program is going to accept new students?
Well, the teaching credential program will only accept about 150, and probably a third to perhaps a half of those are students who are already on campus this fall. So I don't know that it's making that much of an impact on other programs. I think the impact is so large anyway that 150 won't make a huge difference to the other programs. Now, my nursing colleagues will be mad at me if I don't mention that they actually also can accept students in the spring because of the dire nursing shortage in California.
Oh, I see. Okay, I was not informed about that, but that, I guess that's a related situation.
It is related. It is related to the role that the CSU system plays and our mission in staffing public institutions.
Where did these exemptions come from? Did they come from you and your colleagues at the department level asking for this exemption, or did it come from the leadership level at Sac State, or did it come even higher than that? The leaders of the CSU system said, no, we need to make exceptions for teacher and nurse preparation.
I think every level spoke to one another, including the state legislature. And so each campus had to determine, did it make sense given the needs in their region? So for us, the greater Sacramento region, sort of the northern San Joaquin Valley, did it make sense to continue accepting students given the need? And then the provost on our campus, Joe Sheely, who understands the need for teachers, had to speak with the president, who had to speak with the chancellor's office. So it really did go in both directions.
As you said, teachers have been pink-slipped. However, there are a lot fewer options for people to go to public universities in California next spring. Do you think you'll get more applicants because of that?
Well, our deadline's next week for the spring semester, so we'll find out soon. We're getting a lot of inquiries from students who live in other parts of California who've planned for a teaching credential program, and now their own CSU campus is not accepting students. So really, only about a third or to a quarter of the CSU campuses are accepting new credential students. We happen to be one of them. So we may see an unusual increase because of this, which could make the programs even more competitive.
As you said, though, if people want to apply for this program, they need to do it by September 15th, which is what, Tuesday?
Tuesday. That's correct.
Okay. Deidre Sessoms, professor and director of teacher preparation at Sacramento State. Although most CSU programs are closed for new admissions in the spring and fall 2010 semesters, there are some exceptions, including the teacher credentialing programs at Sac State, along with nursing, as it turns out. Deidre, thanks for joining us.
Could I mention one other quick thing?
Go ahead.
Please realize as well, folks, we have an EDD program. We have school counseling, school nurses, school psychology. We prepare for all of the positions that are in your local public school, and we'll be admitting for fall semester into all of those programs.
Okay, thank you. It's the California Capitol Air Show this weekend. One of the pilots performing is Air Force veteran Tim Decker. He lives in Rockland and nowadays does solo aerobatics at air shows. I spoke with Tim yesterday. He was outdoors at Mather Airport and I asked him how he got started doing aerobatics.
Oh, you know, I got started doing aerobatics in the Air Force, believe it or not. When I became a young Air Force pilot, one of the first things they teach you to do, other than take off and land the jets, is to do aerobatics. So you know how to fly them at their full potential during the full part of the envelope. And I just fell in love with it back then, over 20-some years ago. And not only did it flying as an Air Force pilot, but I continued on doing it on my own.
So in the Air Force, they teach you aerobatics not just or not at all for fun, but because there are safety reasons for you to learn how to fly that way.
Exactly. All the fighter type airplanes have to maneuver very aggressively in order to do their jobs. And it's just part of learning to fly combat tactics and that kind of thing. And that's why the Air Force and Navy and Marines, all those pilots learn aerobatics. And boy, I'll just tell you, it stuck with me. And I just love being upside down in an airplane, and even after 20 years of flying some of the best Air Force jets in the world, here I am continuing it on my own.
What kind of jets did you fly in the Air Force?
I was very fortunate. I flew the U-2 spy plane right up here at Beale Air Force Base in Northern California, and I also got a chance to fly the F-117, the stealth fighter, and that was made famous during the Persian Gulf War.
And where did you serve? Did you serve in combat situations?
Yes, I spent time over in the Bosnia Herzegovina area in the whole Kosovo conflict. I did the Persian Gulf, Iraq, and Afghanistan as well.
My guest is Tim Decker, pilot who's performing at the California Capitol Air Show this weekend at Mather Airport. He does solo aerobatics. Tell us about the plane you fly doing aerobatics. It's very different from a U-2.
Yeah, Jeff, the airplane I'm flying this weekend is called a Pitts S2B. It's a small biplane. It only has two seats in it. During the air show, I'll be flying it by myself. And it's just a highly aerobatic airplane that puts on a beautiful show, very exciting, close to the crowd close to the show center, and really would like everyone to come out and see it.
It's very distinctively marked. You got a lot of red and white paint on it. Could you describe what it looks like and why it's painted that way?
Believe it or not, that was a factory paint job. It came from the factory with that paint job, and it's a kind of a classic Pitt Special paint job, and I really like it, and I didn't want to change it.
You say that you fly the Pitts because it's good for this kind of work, for aerobatics. Why is it such an appropriate plane for doing aerobatics?
Well, it was actually designed for aerobatics. It's quite truthfully not very good at some of the other things that you'd want an airplane to be good at, like creature comforts for flying like down to Los Angeles or up to Seattle or something like that. Instead, it's very minimal, lightweight, and very strong, and designed specifically for aerobatics. It does a wonderful job.
I've seen some of the videos on your website, and you look so casual in the cockpit. You can see in the background that the plane is turning at high speed, and you're upside down and so on, and yet you look so casual and you're laughing. Have you always been that way in the cockpit when you're doing your maneuvers?
Yeah, I've practiced those maneuvers 1,000 times. They're very comfortable to me. It might be similar to you, entering a freeway on the local ramp that you've gotten onto 1,000 times. You're comfortable with it. But somebody a new driver wouldn't be comfortable merging into traffic on a freeway. You know what I mean. And so after doing it for this many years, it became very natural.
One of my favorite things that you do that I saw on the video on your website was where your plane had its nose pointing straight up to the sky, and it looked like you're falling straight down to the ground and the plane is rolling around, and then you come out of it. Is that as dangerous as it looks?
Yeah, you wouldn't want to do that without a ton of practice. And that's one of my favorite maneuvers. It's actually called a torque roll. And I roll the airplane going straight up in the vertical, straight up, and then it runs out of energy and it starts falling back down. And the reason it's spinning on the way down backwards is because of the torque of the engine. The propeller spins one way and it causes the airplane to rotate the opposite way. It'd be a great science experiment for a young kid.
How do you know that the airplane is capable of holding up to that? Because I know that when jetliners get into situations where they're falling, it's almost impossible to get them out of the dive.
Exactly. And again, this airplane was designed specifically for these high G maneuvers, and other people have discovered how to do them well before me, and I was able to train with some mentors along the way and learn how to do these maneuvers safely.
My guest is the pilot, Tim Decker. He's at the California Capital Air Show this weekend at Mather. Are there any maneuvers you'd like to do but you just haven't figured out how to do safely yet?
I'm always looking for new maneuvers. I watch tapes of other air shows and other air show performers and see what they're doing out there. And I'm adding some new things. I'll change up my sequence a little bit over the wintertime, and hopefully in 2010 add some new maneuvers out there. But yeah, I'm always looking for stuff, similar to a football team, watching tapes of the other team and seeing what they're doing. I do the same thing.
And are there any maneuvers you don't do anymore because it was just too dangerous?
I avoid what we call snap rolls on the downline, which is it's kind of a mini spin type snap roll while you're pointing either 45 degrees towards the ground or maybe even vertically straight down. I avoid those because I've seen those cause trouble with other aerobatic performers and air show performers. And because I've seen this trend, I avoid those.
I know you also take people up into the air. Do you do...
Yes.
Your toughest maneuvers with passengers, do people sign up to do that with you? And if so, how do they react?
Normally, when I take passengers up, I gear it towards that passenger. Some people will want a real mild ride, and some will want a real wild ride. And I try to build up to it, and then some people are just really loving it, and they're roller coaster type people, and and they'll want to do all those maneuvers like you talked about. And I can't sequence them together like I do in the air show. During an air show, I'm very lightweight. The plane just wouldn't be capable of running a passenger through the whole sequence. But I can do the maneuvers individually, and I actually teach guys how to fly aerobatics as well.
What's it like, the sensation of having multiple G-forces on your body when you're in a dive?
Oh, well, you know, that's a good question. A G, we're all standing around at one G or one gravity right now. So when you pull back on the stick and the G-meter says six Gs, now you weigh six times your normal body weight. So I'm about 200 pounds. So at six Gs, I weigh 1,200 pounds. 200 times 6, and so it's pretty severe. It's hard to lift your arms. If you look in a mirror, you can see what you're going to look like in 30 or 40 years as your face sags.
How could you respond quickly in a dangerous situation if your body's weighing 1,200 pounds?
Well, as a pilot, I can release the stick a little bit to lessen the G's. If I'm having trouble at the high G's, I won't pull back quite as hard. And that will lessen the G's. The problem is you don't want to get yourself in a corner where you need a hard pull in order to avoid hitting the ground. And so you have to leave some buffer and some safety zones so that you don't find yourself unable to react as you asked.
Tim, finally, what other things are going on at the air show that you know about?
We're going to have the Thunderbirds, the U.S. Air Force jet team. That's going to be our main act. And in fact, this year, where there's two jet teams, there's another jet team called the Patriots. They fly L-39s. And so, it's just a wonderful event this weekend. Lots of civilian performers. One of my friends, Dan Buchanan, he's a great story. He's a paraplegic. And he flies a hang glider, believe it or not, in the air show. So I really encourage everyone to come out, enjoy the show. Kids 12 and under are free. So please, come on out and see the show.
Tim Decker, he's a pilot. He lives in Rockland. He does solo aerobatics. He's performing at the California Capital Air Show this weekend at Mather Airport in Sacramento County. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Tim was outdoors at Mather when I talked with him. Thanks to Joey Jones for production assistance with that interview. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, you'll meet a couple of the dozens of Sacramento artists opening the studios this weekend. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. I got started in radio as an intern. Many people in public radio did. Apply to be an Insight intern. You'll find out how on the careers page at capradio.org. Dozens of Sacramento painters, sculptors, and other artists are opening the studios this weekend. Two of those artists join us, but first, the chair of the Open Studio Tour. The group that's organizing it is the Center for Contemporary Art Sacramento. She's Cheryl Holben. Cheryl, welcome.
Thank you.
What's the point of opening dozens of studios? Are there enough people to go around and see all these artists?
We hope there's enough people. The tour is free. There's 92 artists on the tour. It's all within a 4-mile radius of Midtown, so it's quite doable on foot or on bike, covering a lot of ground in a short amount of time.
And how on earth could you find all these places?
You can go to our website, www.ccasac.org, and download the map.
Doesn't this sound a lot like Second Saturday?
It is like Second Saturday, but it's not, because there's a rare opportunity to actually visit with the artists firsthand, ask questions, and see the environment in which they work.
Yeah. Cheryl Holben is chair of the Center for Contemporary Art Sacramento's Open Studio Tour. Also with us are two of the artists, Liv Moe and Omer Arison. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Liv, what kind of artist are you?
Oh, God. I always stumble on that question. I guess mixed media would be the easiest way to put it.
I do
a range of practices, so sculpture, photography, a little bit of documentary film. Usually the medium follows the idea that I have.
Okay. And Omer, what kind of artist are you?
Painter, absolutely.
Okay. Now, when you open your studios to people, what's that like? Liv, have you done it much before?
Mm-hmm. This will be the fourth year that I'll be on the tour. And it's interesting. Sometimes people come in and they just get completely overwhelmed by what's on the walls because it is different than going in a gallery. You're looking at somebody's process as opposed to finished works, usually. Sometimes people just put up finished work. But, you know, sometimes people get intimidated by that and they don't know where to begin. But then, you know, the good visits, what you hope for is people who start asking you questions and they go in there and go, what is going on? What is all this stuff?
Are you actually working when the tour is on?
Usually not, because it's, you know, the last couple of years have been pretty busy. So you're engaging with people. But that's usually what I fill the spare time with between visitors, if I can.
Now, it sounds like your art is quite eclectic. Can you show all of your art in your studio, like your documentary film?
I could, yeah. The short documentary I made is on YouTube, too. So sometimes I recommend, or, you know, I refer people to that.
Well, what are you going to have for people to see if they come to your studio?
I'll have some of the sculptural works that I've been making with hair. I've been working with hair for a couple of years.
Human hair?
Human hair and fake hair, synthetic hair and wigs, found wigs. So I'll have that and then my photography work.
And when you say sculptures with hair, what kind of sculptures? What are these sculptures of?
Primarily hair. I started working with wigs a couple years ago, and I just thought wigs are this funny idea because they are a facade. You know, you're putting on this fake thing, and people don't really do, they don't really wear wigs anymore, so it's also kind of a generational thing or time period. So I started pairing wigs with various materials, and then they become kind of like little environments on the wall.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, like little forests.
Omar, what about you? What's it like for you when you open your studio and people come in?
For me, I get very nervous. It's kind of like showing your laundry. There's a lot of unfinished work that you perhaps aren't very comfortable with yet, and then you're going to get questions about those, and it's kind of exciting.
So you don't hide the unfinished work?
I try not to. I like to keep it a sort of an honest experience where they come in and they'll see a bit of a mess on the floor. Basically, see it as a working studio, not as a gallery showing where you'd normally see the work.
What's the benefit for the people who see it and for you as the artist of this unfinished work?
I think it's basically the lives of an artist are always somewhat shrouded in mystery. People think there's something really special going on, and I think this is you get a glimpse into that, and it's a moment of truth rather than seeing in a very sort of sterile environment. You get to see the meat and bones that go on behind it.
Yeah. Do you do any painting work while people come to visit your studio?
Oh, no. I'm too self-conscious for that. But
yeah?
I'll fill the downtime with some doodling or watercolors or just walk around myself.
When you say you're too self-conscious for that, is that because you never like to have people around when you're painting? Or is it just the something about this open tour type of format that makes it a little bit more disconcerting, perhaps?
It might be just painting. I can't speak for other art forms, but it seems like it's a very, very solitary thing, something I do on my own, and other people don't fit well into that. So I find that virtually impossible to do. I can't focus.
Where's your studio?
It's on 19th and V Street, Big Blue, former Napa Auto Parts, a beautiful warehouse, and we have some excellent studios in there and some great work.
And Liv, I know you're associate director of the Verge Gallery and Studio Project. Is that where your studio is?
Yeah, Omar and I are in the same complex, so we're both at the Verge.
Now, Cheryl, you're chair of the Open Studio Tour. Are you also an artist?
No, I would like to be one. I have tried it and failed along the way. I'm one of those people who think something looks really easy and have found out along the way it is actually not. So for me, it's enjoyable to see the process in action and then as well see the finished result and all that goes into creating beautiful work.
How many studios do you think you'll see?
Well, last year I made it on bike to all 80 studios.
Over one weekend?
Over one weekend. This year, I don't think I'm going to be quite so ambitious, but I do hope to make it to at least half of them. It's one of my favorite weekends of the entire year.
Because there are 92 studios?
92 studios.
Although they are all within a few miles.
They're all within 4 miles. And yes, I could make it to all 92 if I just wanted to walk in, say hi, and leave. But that's not what the tour is about. I really want to be able to go in and enjoy the whole experience and visit with the artists.
What about a first-time tour goer, someone who's listening and going, well, that sounds pretty cool, but 92 studios, how do I even get started? How do I know where to go?
they can come down to the Center for Contemporary Art. The show is up there. The hours are 11 to 5, both days this weekend, as well as 12 to 5 today. About two-thirds of the artists have their artwork showing there. So I would suggest they come down and preview the show, pick four of their favorite pieces, and then I always encourage them to pick one more, something that they're not comfortable with, something that's not their style, and broaden their perspectives a little bit.
How much time would you suggest someone put aside for this?
You know, really, we've had some people come on the tour and spend an hour or two at one studio. And, you know, that's wonderful. If they make it to one studio and dedicate a full hour there, and it's a great experience for them. But really, whatever they want to dedicate to it.
And would you recommend people do it by foot, by bike, by car, whatever?
Whatever is fine. I think doing it by bike, Sacramento is such a dynamic city, and it's really fun just biking around. Not only do you get to go see the artist studios, but there's a lot of murals up on the buildings now and some great architecture that you can only see on a bike or by foot.
Liv, do you expect to sell work in open studio tours, or is it more of a general awareness marketing type of goal that you have?
I think it's kind of both. I mean, I think one of the things that's exciting about studio tours and being able to go into people's studios is to understand, like Omar was saying, understand how work gets made, especially if it's a new media artist or somebody who works in digital media or something that's kind of strange. You get this understanding of how that happens, you know, how that work comes together. And yeah, I do sell work on studio tours. It's not necessarily my intention. I mean, it's great when it happens, but I don't, you know, I'm more just excited about having people come in and engage with what I do.
What about you, Omar? Do you expect to sell works? Hope to sell works?
Oh, we always hope, but expect, I'd say probably not, although it's always an option. And it, yeah. Like Liv says, it's nice when it happens.
We've been talking about the Open Studio Tour this weekend, organized by the Center for Contemporary Art Sacramento. The Open Studios are from 12 noon to 4 p.m., both Saturday and Sunday. There's also an opening reception from 6 to 9 p.m. on Saturday evening at the CCAS premises at 1599 9th Street. Cheryl Holben, chair of the tour, and artists Liv Moe and Omar Arison, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, country musician Elliot Randall sings in our studio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with something you heard on Insight? Tell us what and why at insight@capradio.org. Country rock Americana artist Elliot Randall is in town tonight. The San Francisco-based singer, guitarist, songwriter, and his band are playing at Sacramento's Fox and Goose. Elliot Randall and two band members are in our studio, and they'll do a stripped-down version of one of their songs. But before we meet them, here's a sample from Elliot's most recent album, Take the Fall. It's the song How to Get Old.
Greyhound station on Christmas Eve, I was carrying a present for you. Wrapped up in my classifieds, and it's in between my shoes. 2 whole years, 2 whole years, I wonder now you have changed. You were always good, getting old. Highway dreams, they run dry. Small.
Elliot Randall, welcome to the Insight Studio.
Yes, thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Were you raised a country boy?
I guess you could say that, yeah. All my family's from the South, South Carolina, and country music's in my blood. My dad is a country songwriter. His father was a country musician, so it's just, you can't get away from it.
What kind of country music were they doing?
Both kinds.
Yeah, both kinds, country and western. They were doing... you know, like sort of like Johnny Cash. My dad, big fan of like Johnny Cash. Willie Nelson is his favorite of all time. Patsy Cline, old country, good country.
Skynyrd.
Skynyrd, yeah.
Also with Elliot are two band members, as I said, Danilo Lopez and James DePrieto. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Danilo, you're the bassist?
I am.
And James, you're the guitarist.
And whatever else we could fit in the back of a van, yeah.
Yeah.
Play it.
But Elliot, the band is more than the three of you. There's a couple of
others. Yeah, we have... we have like sort of a rotating thing with a pedal steel guitar and keyboards, organ, and then a drummer as well. And we do a lot of singing, like, you know, 3-4 part harmony type stuff.
Danilo, are you a country musician by background?
No, actually. I'm a rock musician by background, but I like Elliot's songwriting, so he had me.
So when you see a rock, like what kind of music?
Name anywhere from Black Sabbath to... I don't know, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, anything like that.
Yeah, well, this is a very different sound.
Very different.
You'd be surprised that there's a little bit of a cross ground between like real hardcore rockers and old traditionalists with country music. It's both got the same, all the songs are still about fighting and drinking and heartbreak, you know, right?
It's all the same party.
Yeah. And James DePrieto, what about your musical background? Country guy?
Like country, rock and roll. Been playing guitar since I was big enough to hold one, you know, and I guess I'm an old country rocker, southern rocker too.
The clip of the song we heard before, that was recorded in a studio from the album Take the Fall. It's the full band. It's a stripped down version of the band today. Elliot, what song are we going to hear?
You're going to hear a song called Caffeine and Gasoline, and it's a stripped down version of the song that is the title track off of the upcoming album Caffeine and Gasoline, which we will be releasing in probably November of this year.
Okay, in our studio, Elliot Randall and band members Danilo Lopez and James DePrieto. It's Insight.
Spend a little money just to get the truck running again. Coming up from Tucson, Cary, New Mexico, and time sure moves slow. When you got somewhere to be, Lord, give me some caffeine. I'm gonna find my way.
Playing in our studio, Elliot Randall, country rock musician with two members of his band. He and the whole band are playing Sacramento's Fox and Goose tonight. And that song, there's a studio version of it. Caffeine and Gasoline will be the title track on Elliot's next album. And when's it coming out, Elliot?
November of this year, we'll be releasing it.
You said you're from the South, but you live in the Bay Area now. How did that come about?
Well, I've lived in California and South Carolina sort of off and on, and I grew up a large part of my childhood in South Carolina, and my family's all from there. And then high school, right before high school, I moved out here and went to high school in the Bay Area. But, I don't know. I'm just like a half California, half Southern, you know. All my family's back there. It's kind of place where I feel most connected to home.
Yeah. Guitarist James DePrado, where are you from?
Well, Elliot's from the South and from California. I'm just from Southern California. So I grew up in a Riverside town called Norco, a little horse town that nobody's ever heard of. And I bet you $100 you can't find it on a map.
And what about you, Danilo Lopez? Where are you from?
I'm from Italy originally.
Oh.
Born and raised.
How did you come to move over here?
Came to meet my parents over here and moved here when I was 15. Jumped into high school, didn't speak a word of English, and it was a lot of fun.
Did a good job shaking off that accent, though, huh?
Yeah.
Elliot, what about writing your songs? How do you do that?
I'll write down. I'm always writing, and you know, and then I'll write down a tune, bring it in. I usually stick to one chord, and I know how to play the G chord all right on a guitar, so I'll do that.
That's all you need.
I'll bring in the G chord. I mean, it's country music. All I need is the G chord.
So a lot of songs in G.
Yeah, so I'll bring in a song inevitably in G, and I'll play it for the guys. And while I'll do all the lyric stuff, they help a lot in arranging the tune. I'll usually come in with an idea with a chorus and in the verse, but we'll fill it in with instrumental stuff and a bridge if we need it. So they help out big time with that. I mean, that's how we developed a band sound, you know. Otherwise, I'd just be another singer-songwriter.
And the big part of the harmonies, too, there's a guy that plays with us, the drummer, Kyle Caprista. He's really good and on point at coming up with stuff, too, and it's really good.
Elliot, who do you like listening to apart from Elliot Randall and company?
Not much. I mean, there's no. I listen to all sorts of stuff, but I listen to, like, right now I'm on a kick, Delbert McClinton, the band, early Elton John. I'm into like Wayne Newton and
this is pretty eclectic.
Dolly
so
Parton.
I'm not hearing too much early Elton John in your music.
No, but I am. But early Elton John is so honky tonk, you know. I mean, it's like Southern rock, and so a lot of people forget that. So that's where you got to start, Southern rock, and I'm all about that.
In July, you open for Steve Miller.
Yeah,
as in the Steve Miller Band.
Yeah, yes, as in the Steve Miller Band. We got to do two shows with Steve Miller Band, and it was awesome for me because I kind of grew up, I mean, who didn't at least hear those records, you know, over and over and over and over and over. But it was amazing to open up for him because it's always a trip to be like, get to meet and hang out with someone who wrote all those songs that everyone knows so well, you know.
Now you're playing at the Fox and Goose tonight, but there's someone else on the bill.
There is. We're playing with Gina Villalobos, who's going to be on tour with us. We're going down through California, and you can check us out on the website, ellierandall.com. It's got all the tour details, but Gina's going to be playing with us, and Kate Gaffney is a Sacramento, really talented Sacramento singer-songwriter. She's on the bill as well.
Yeah, she's been in our show.
Cool.
She's great. What about Gina? How would you describe her music?
Modern-day Lucinda Williams kind of vibe, I'd say. That kind of dark, Americana outlaw country kind of vibe, I'd say.
Yeah,
she's great. We're going to burn the house down. Come out.
Sounds like it. Well, thanks so much. Elliot Randall, country rock musician. He and his band are playing Sacramento's Fox and Goose tonight. Their most recent album is Take the Fall. The next one coming out later this year is going to be called Caffeine and Gasoline, also with us, and they played in the stripped-down version of the song Caffeine and Gasoline, Danilo Lopez, the bassist, and James DePrado, guitarist. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us.
And that's Insight for this week. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Kelly Minnemeyer. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Our executive producer is Carl Watanabe, and thank you for joining us.